And speaking of Facebook, it's among the technology companies trying to get more computer science into schools. And that's something that Reshma Sajani is doing as well. She's the CEO of Girls Who Code. That's a nonprofit that works to increase the number of women in computer science by teaching it to young women in high school during summer workshops. And she'll be doing some of those workshops in Boston this summer. Sajani's also a former candidate for Congress and for public advocate in New York, and she says those failed campaigns helped her succeed. Reshma Sajani joins us in studio to tell us more. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, you're so welcome. Very excited to be here.
I've read that you said your mission is to build the largest pipeline of future female engineers in the United States.
Absolutely.
It's a big mission.
It's a big, big mission. And I think we're getting there. I have a lot of faith that, you know, there's a lot of problems in the world I think that we want to solve, but this is actually one that I really believe that we can solve. We can close the gender gap in computer science and technology, and I think we can do it in our lifetimes.
So that's why you started Girls Who Code?
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually a quite unlikely person to start an organization teaching girls to code. I'm not a coder. I didn't major in computer science. My family came here as refugees, and I've always been passionate about public service. And I was running for office in when I was 33 years old. I ran for United States Congress in New York City. I lost miserably, but I saw the gender divide in schools. And again, as someone who's had a job since they were 12 years old and am a firm believer in the American dream, I was like, where are the girls? Like, we know that, you know, women are the majority in college, the majority in our labor force, 45% of American breadwinners. And we know that the future is in technology.
And you have some unbelievable statistics in terms of young women who take advanced placement computer science classes. Yeah. Tell me some of
those. Sure. So essentially in the 1980s, about 37% of computer science graduates were women. And today that number is less than 18%. We have about 500,000 open jobs in computing. But women make up only 24% of the computing workforce. And actually, in 10 years, if nothing changes, will be 22%. So in some ways, the problem is getting worse. And there's also a systematic educational problem, too. You know, only 1 out of 10 American high schools offers computer science. So the vast majority of our children, boys and girls, don't get access to learn a skill set that they need to survive in the 21st century. And it's very impactful when it comes to women, because most studies will show that if a young girl hasn't taken computer science in high school, she's unlikely to go take it in college.
So you look at all of this and you see the lack of women in technology and the lack of young girls getting into this, and you want to figure out why. Have you figured it out? Tell us why this is happening.
So I think I have two big things that I think. One, I think, is culture. Like, I think you can't be what you cannot see. I'm an attorney. I decided I wanted to be a lawyer when I was like 13 years old. When I saw Kelly McGillis on The Accused, I thought she was awesome. And I was like, Dad, I want to be her. And I think, you know, if you think about it, in the 1970s, we had a similar problem when it came to female lawyers. Only, you know, what was it, less than 5% of lawyers in the 1970s were women. And today that number is over 50%. You know, you can't be what you cannot see.
But you became this. And
yes,
you
because I saw Kelly McGillis on The Accused.
But also that you're doing this coding.
Yes,
you know, as
but
well.
I think I'm doing – but I think that – I guess my point is that culture really shapes what young girls think that they can do. And I think in technology, the opposite thing has happened. In the 1980s, you saw kind of the birth of the programmer, right? The white guy in a hoodie who's sitting in a basement somewhere, you know, staring at a screen. And that was in Revenge of the Nerds and War Games, right? And today on Silicon Valley on HBO. So the image that we have portrayed in the media of who is a computer scientist is a white young kid who's nerdy and dorky, and he's not doing anything that's socially interesting. And so girls look at him and they say, I don't want to be him. And they opt out. Mm. And so you see this really opting out happening in high school, when I think the girls are the most susceptible to culture.
Explain a little bit about your program, Girls Who Code. It works in the summer.
We have two models. We have a summer immersion program. So we essentially build a summer camp in a technology company. This summer we have three in Boston, and it's a free program for rising juniors and seniors in high school. And for 7 weeks they learn how to code, and at the end of those 7 weeks they actually build a product. And the results have been phenomenal. This is our sixth summer. Oh, my God. The results have been amazing. 90% of our graduates in that program are going on to major or minor in computer science. Mm-hmm. So it's converting their interest.
Is there a way to work with schools?
Yes.
Instead of doing a separate program. You're doing some, right?
Yes.
There's some clubs after school, but what about really integrating?
In-school program. It's a great question. And we think about this a lot. There's a large movement to get computer science in every classroom. And that movement is by getting computer science to be elective, right? So it's not a mandatory requirement. So then what happens is that you don't change the gender dynamics because you haven't changed the culture part that we talked about, some of the bravery things that I talk about. And so what we're trying to do is as we support in-classroom programs is to say, okay, what's the impact of those programs on girls? Like, do you have role models? Are you showcasing the original pioneers of computer science? Are you thinking constructively about how you're calling on girls for questions and how you're teaching computer science so it's project-based, right? And it's computational thinking, and it's not just about regurgitating a programming language that they may not feel connected to. But of course, the way to solve this problem the fastest is through in-classroom instruction. But we believe that until that happens and until it's, quite frankly, mandatory, the after-school programs play a critical role because it brings girls to come together in a single-sex environment that they feel confident in their abilities.
And you think that's important to be in
Huge.
A single-sex environment?
Huh? Huge. I do. You know, I think that we have not raised our girls to be comfortable with failure. And they feel like so many of their abilities are fixed. So imagine if you're in a computer science class, you're 16 years old, you're the only girl. You have all these loud, brash boys who are like, I know the answer. I built a video game when I was 2 years old. And you're struggling because coding is hard for everyone. Mm. You're likely to drop out. And that's what's happening across classrooms across the country.
But, you know, it's happening in other fields, too. We've been talking about this for a long time, right?
Yeah.
About the wage disparity between women and men, right? And all of the, and I'm old enough to know that we've been talking about different academic achievement rates in certain fields like science and math for young men and young women. And so you get to something, I think, very profound there in terms of women and women being able to assert themselves and feel confident in themselves. And that, how do you teach that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's about how do you undo perfectionism, right? And how do you teach girls to embrace bravery? And so I think one of the ways that I think about this is, you know, when you're great, whether it's you're a great athlete, a great leader, you're often living at the edge of your ability in critical feedback. So you need critical feedback to get better. So if I've been raised to feel like I need to be perfect at everything, when I hear feedback, it doesn't feel good. And it makes me feel like I can't do this and I need to go find something else that I'm immediately good at. And so to me, it's about figuring out how do we get girls comfortable at a really early age with critical feedback and with rejection. So like one tactic that I use is if you had met me when I was 16 or if you are at 41, if you come to my house right now, I have a rejection letter on my refrigerator. I was recently rejected from my community board, which is like the lowest level of government that you can serve in.
Oh no.
For their education committee. Something that you think maybe I know something about. But I put that letter up and it hurt to not get in and to not be able to serve. But I put that letter up on my fridge to just remind myself, right, that I can keep trying and it's not going to break me. And I know that I know something about education. Like, I know that I would do well on that committee. Their loss. Hmm. And so instead of it breaking me, how do you get rejection and feedback to embolden you to be better, to try harder, and to not let someone else's judgment on your worth affect your own self-confidence? It's funny, my son's 2 years old, and so I was recently at his music class, and, you know, listen, I'm a busy mom. Like, if you meet my son, he normally, like, has a booger in his nose, and there's, like, food filled on him, and, like, I call him my little pig pen, right? But it is what it is, right? And it was funny when I was sitting with him at his music class, I was watching the little girls and all of them, like perfect little bows, immaculately dressed. Their bow moved to the left or the right, the nanny or the mother would come up and fix it. So, like, imagine at 2 years old, you're constantly pricked and prodded, and you know what I mean? Like, in that, those micro acts add up.
But what about those brash boys in the classroom? Why are they not affected? Your son may be baby Pigpen.
They're not.
But there are other boys who also have to have perfect haircuts before they go to public events.
And they have
those pressures as well. So, and they do become those brash people. They don't put that rejection letter on the refrigerator, right? Mm-hmm. They don't even talk about it. They pretend it never happened. And so, and once you get into a professional setting, those men are getting promoted, even if they may know less than their female counterpart. What do you do about that?
So I think it's because... And there's been a lot talked about this. It's because I think women are rewarded for their performance and men are rewarded for their potential. Like, I think about, for me, you know, I've lost two races. And I do think if I run again one day, I'm going to be judged much more harshly for those failures than if it was a similarly situated man who lost a bunch of times, who's had now a proven track record of actually building something. His failures are going to be seen as successes. One thing I will say is that I do believe that I was one of the national organizers of the Women's March, and I'm, you know, very active on lots of different issues, but we have found our voice. You know, women
think so?
Absolutely. I think women have found their voice. Like, women are outraged, and we're using our voice, and we're not going to take it anymore. That doesn't mean everything's going to change tomorrow, but I am much more hopeful about the state of our affairs.
Reshma Sajani is the founder and CEO of Girls Who Code. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Stay with us. Coming up, the new tech sensation called blockchain. What is it? I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.